blessings and best wishes to all. Reggie Hubbard here, dialing in from the DC metro area, Maryland, where I am full of spontaneous joy after watching the first black male governor in Maryland's history descend down a house built by slaves this afternoon. I'm from Maryland. I went to high school not that far from where I am now. Wes Moore is 44, I'm 48. And with all due respect to the former president, like, Wes is my dude. You know what I mean? Because he's my generation, like my state. And to watch Wes walk down kind of just stoked the fire that already existed in me just to be untamed. You know what I mean? Like, in 2 years, I've gone from not teaching at all to taking the Dharma world by storm, to taking the yoga world by storm, and I don't care. Meaning, sometimes I curse, but that's because I use precise language. You know, like, and I grew up in the hip hop era. You know, I know what the hell I'm saying. I went to Yale, I majored in philosophy. You know what I mean? I've been writing since I was 4. Like, I know the words that I'm speaking, and if they cause you to clutch your pearls, maybe you should get mala instead, right? Instead of clutching your pearls, maybe you should use your beads to pray. That's kind of how I moved through the world. And a little bit about me, I majored in philosophy in college because I had a really traumatic experience being first generation at Yale. One. Two is that my brother's best friend committed suicide, and my grandfather died, and I was almost expelled from Yale for throwing a Stop the Violence concert in my sophomore year. So I had the dark night of the soul at 18 and a half, 19 years old. And luckily for me, I found existential philosophy to guide me through the dark night of the soul, which meant my 20s and 30s were like a circuitous path, but in the mid 40s, I'm hitting my stride. Right, been through some things, have the language to talk about it, have traversed the path of anger by being a black man in this society which seeks to demean and destroy us. I mean, they killed that brother from DC in LA, and no one's talking about it. You know what I mean? It didn't even make the national news. Like, you know, one of America's favorite pastimes is killing niggas. And if you read the book, Brother King talks about that. Elder King, you know. So another way I'm showing up to you tonight is extremely blessed, not only by Wes Moore, but through the intricacies of the universe, I accidentally met Martin Luther King III on Sunday. Yeah, so a friend of mine was like, you should come to this thing with the Kings. And I've been on deadline for my book, and I've been in all these other places. So I'm like, the Kings, like, of comedy? So I was totally just not there. And then I was like, oh. Okay, my bad. Right, so had occasion not only to, like, meet them. I didn't take any pictures because I'm solidly Gen X. Like, to meet them on King weekend as a black person from the South, like that's, I don't need a picture for that. You know what I mean? Like, that's just some stuff I share with my ancestors. So people are like, where are your pictures? Like, it's in my mind, homie. I'm not gonna be like, hey, elder, like, your parents were both angels. Can we take this for the gram? That's not how I roll, right? I believe in presence. And if it were given to me spontaneously, it's meant to experience, not necessarily to document. Because I didn't plan on that. A week ago, I wasn't like, oh, I'm going to go to this thing. Right? I was like, it was like 2 days before. A friend of mine was in town. I was like, I'm producing this thing with the Kings. And I'm like, oh, okay, sure. So I believe in the miracle that exists when you radically embrace the present moment. Mm-hmm. Right? When you get out of the way of the stories that you tell yourself or the stories that have been foisted upon you. Like, one of the blessings of my 40s was my deep dive into Dharma practice. Because I, when I read the phrase, like, delusion is a cause of suffering, it just awakened the liberation that I've been seeking as a black guy, right? Like, I'm deluded in thinking, because like I said, if the national pastime for the police is killing us, right, it's not gonna change in my lifetime. It's not. And that's not on, that doesn't mean it can't change, it's not likely that it will. That doesn't mean that I don't continue to work for that change. It just means for me to hold hope that it's gonna fall out of the sky. You have consistently demonstrated for 300 years that you view your role as to kill us and then keep communities safe. right? So being present allows me not only to see the history of this, but see what happens when I denounce addiction to that misguided hope, and then stand fully in the hope of present moment awareness. So that's how I show up. These practices for me are tactile. I use them all the time, right? Like, I'm the yogi who teaches. I don't consider myself a yoga teacher because that's fraught with all this other stuff. First of all, I'm not a skinny white chick from the burbs, right? I'm a big boned brother from Baltimore, right? So for me, my embodied existence is my practice, right? So being fully embodied in, as Jerry talked about, the ridiculous cross intersections of my life, right? So first generation, but super connected, right? Mm-hmm. And humble about it. Like, the only reason you know about my connections is someone else probably talked about it. I'm not like that's another reason why I think I was successful in Washington, because I'm not like, oh, you know, the other day when I was in so-and-so's office. That shit is gross. It's more important for me to have those relationships as tools to effectuate social change than to talk about, you know, whatever. So that's who I am. That's how I'm showing up to you today. My teaching practice was born online. So if my energy's a lot, it's because I'm willingly placing it here.
Mm.
Like, I'm like,
mm-hmm.
Because this is who we truly are, right? Spirit, that's who we are. We are spiritual beings having a physical experience. And so embracing the energetics of our true nature and then unleashing that. So if you've ever seen memes of Buddha, like, one of my favorite ones is he's holding the mudra, eyes closed or downcast, and it's just vibrating. So the peace, the love, the things that we talk about in practice are so embodied that they just radiate. That's what I'm going for in this life. Like, one of the best compliments I've received was from Ayanna Pressley, when she was like, brother, let me tell you something about you. And I was like, oh shit, sister, what are you gonna say? And she was like, your vibe is so cool that when you walk into the room, the blood pressure drops. And I was just like, don't you know that that is the whole reason why I do all this stuff? To be the embodiment of radical grace, radical truth, with humility, not on some YOLO shit. Right, so radical presence, but from a loving place. Not like I told you so, you know. The phrase I use often is, might you consider this? As opposed to, you dead wrong. Like, might you consider this? Like, yogic and Buddhist practice have given me that gem. So what I'd like to do, that's how I'm showing up. That's who I am in a nutshell. And again, I wasn't really teaching at all two and a half years ago. Pandemic hits, George Floyd gets killed. I basically, two of my heroes in life, three of them, Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman, and Nat Turner. So, like, when the pandemic hit, I looked around and it was like, the matrix is broken, right? Like, so the white supremacist matrix of the wellness industry is broken. I'm gonna come in and be the thing that you didn't know that you needed. And so, like, started teaching, like, hardcore, like, April the 4th, 2020, and really haven't stopped since. And have coupled my teaching practice with deeper study of Hatha yoga, of Dharma, both Zen and other aspects of Tibetan practice. And one of my teachers and mentors is like, Reggie, what I love about you is that your spiritual practice, you're very open about it, but it's a braided tapestry of the things that you've studied and the things that you've lived. So it's an and, it's not an or. So I grew up in the Baptist church, which is why I'm comfortable with spiritual conversations. I don't subscribe to dogmatic stuff anymore, because Jesus wasn't white and he was a radical who was killed by the state. You know what I mean? So, like, that's it. So I've left the dogmatic aspects of practice, but that Christian practice was what I grew up with. So when I found philosophy, when I found yoga, when I found the Dharma practice, I was already practiced in something. So as the truth of these ancient wisdom traditions manifested in my life, I was like, oh, this is great. Like, where you been all my life? Oh, you've always been here. I was ignorant. Okay, right on. And so, like, have used these tools to construct such resilience in my inner world that the outer world is superfluous. You know, I used to hold space with people on when we talked about impeachment, that before impeachment was popular, only 6 people believed it was possible.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So mm-hmm. holding space for the complex and having the discipline to keep revisiting. So whether that be your cushion or your practice or deep conversation or your organizing, like these are critical elements of my embodied philosophy as a teacher. But also, I believe the best teachers are hardcore practitioners. So I'm a hardcore mm-hmm. practitioner first, and delighted to be in community with you. How I'd like to start after this long-winded introduction is with sound, right? So I'm sure you've been in studies all day and you've lived your life or whatever. So before we get into the depth of the conversation, I want to give you the biggest gift that I've received over the past 2 years, which is an attuned ear. So I've got sound bowls here, I've got gongs. When I met Jerry, the collection was super small. So Jerry, if you can see in the back there, that room is my gong room.
Okay. Right, I can see some gongs.
Yeah, so there are 2 of them out here, but they're like 14 in the back.
Oh, wow.
Different things.
You've been collecting.
Practice has made me present, has shown me the precognitive nature of sound and how much we fill our lives with noise. So before we have a heartfelt conversation, let's clear the mind, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
So begin by shrugging the shoulders or maybe working the wrists a bit, because we sit tense for hours and there's no way you can have a deep conversation if you've been like this for hours. Mm-hmm. I mean, so whether it's deep shrugs, whether it's Beyonce influenced sass or Nikki, whatever. So just get into your shoulders, your neck, and your wrists as they are designed. They're designed for fluid motion. They're not designed to be like this, right? So get back into the design of these things. For another 10 seconds or so. Then bring palms together, create friction in the palms. Notice how good it feels to bring attention and loving awareness to the hands. And then just love on the hands. We typically wring our hands in despair, not for therapeutic reasons. Create friction in the hands one more time. Notice how the hands are like, oh shit, they're serious. They really mean this. And then take heated hands and place them on the cheeks and below. So notice what stress may exist in the jaw area, the underside of the ear, the nostrils, etc. Lastly, frictionate the palms. Then place palms on the cheeks up. So that's eyes, sides of the nose, eye socket, temple, forehead, etc. Release the hands from the eyes and then come into a posture that allows you to feel spacious and grounded. Allow the shoulders to melt down the back so that the heart is open subtly. Feel the body connected to the ground. Feel the breath in the body for the gift that it is. And on your own, begin to inhale and exhale at a cadence that's deeper than normal, but steady. Notice how visiting with your shoulders, wrists, hands, and face, perhaps suspended time a bit, but got you into not only a somatic alignment, but an energetic alignment. So as you presence yourself with your breath, as you feel the ground beneath the body, allow these sounds that I play to soften the mind. I'll begin with a wind gong. Imagine this wind gong sweeping away any debris from limiting thoughts. Sound is a chow gong in celebration of Westmore. We'll throw some chimes in for that celebration. For Black Boy Magic. Now shifting to crystal bowls, enjoy the pentatonic scale at first. If you don't, that's all the sharps in the scale. As the crystal bowls fade away, the last sound I'll offer is a gong specifically tuned to the heart. In preparation for the conversation we're about to have, let's soften the heart. Spend the next 30 seconds in relative silence and stillness, just presencing yourself with who you are now on the other side of this sonic experience. Now pressing palms together with purpose. Three clearing breaths into the belly, exhale out the mouth. So inhale fills the belly, ribs, and chest. Exhale clear, one. Inhale deeply through the nose, fill the belly, ribs, and chest. Exhale clear. Last time, still pressing into the palms with purpose. Inhale through the nose, fills belly, ribs, and chest. Exhale, clear. Lowering head towards hands, surrendering the all-knowing mind to the compassionate, wise heart, seemingly all-knowing mind. And as you're ready, open your eyes, lift the gaze. Welcome back. How do we feel?
open.
Right. So I use sound a lot because it's precognitive, right? You can't, like, when we begin to talk about this type of stuff we're about to talk about, it's a lot. And we start to seize up before we know it. So listening to stuff that calms the mind, allows the body relax, heart opens, so we can have a heartfelt conversation about a difficult subject in community. So for my teachers, I just gave you my special sauce. Most teachers keep it a secret. You can't take this shit with you. So why not? And guess what? People can't cook it like you do. Give them the recipe. That'd be all right. So from this space of openness, of the, you don't even know that you're smiling because you're so mellow, right? Let's talk about what we're here to talk about, right? So it's beautiful that we're talking about this book and this concept at this time, because when we talk about deepening / sharing insight and vision until systemic oppression is erased, that presupposes a couple of things to me. One is that it presupposes persistence and resilience, right? So until. A naive reading of that statement is until erased, right? Like, is that even possible, right? But looking at it deeper, to me, it personifies persistence and resilience. And what I'm gonna do is illustrate this through, I'm glad that I agreed to teach this, because rereading this was the greatest experience. This book I got in college. I was in college a million years ago. So there are notes that I took in here in like the 90s, right? So it's interesting for the 90s, for 2020s Reggie, to see what 90s Reggie thought. It's just, it was a beautiful experience. The first quote I'm gonna read is from the introduction. You may not have the version that I do, but the introduction, Elder King says the following, you know, about how and why he can't wait. In 1963, the boy in Harlem stood up. The girl in Birmingham arose. Separated by stretching miles, both of them squared their shoulders and lifted their eyes towards heaven. Across the miles, they joined hands, took a firm step forward. It was a step that rocked the richest, most powerful nations to its foundation. This is the story of that boy and that girl. This is why we can't wait. Right? So that sentence, in the context of what we're talking about, deepening and sharing insight, how resourced must you be to write something like that from a jail? In the 60s, as a dark-skinned Black man, right? To say, yeah, I know that y'all, this is where I'm going. You have to be unrelenting in your internal work in order to manifest what you hope to see in the external world. You have to be in discipline practice. You have to be in practice of speaking the truth when it's inconvenient with compassion, love, and grace. You have to be aware that you may not see the changes that you hope for, but the labor that you do in service to the changes that you hope for is not in vain. And that's a radical shift from the way that most people view this stuff, right? I view my activist work and my spiritual work as a continuation of an eternal lineage. Yeah, it's coming through like Black hippie and all this other stuff, but I'm just saying stuff that people have been saying for thousands of years, perhaps a little bit more attuned to the hip hop audience and activists. Like, one of the best compliments I got on Capitol Hill recently is like, can't nobody else teach me this shit, Reggie, but you. I was like, he's like, you get me, right? And you curse and you're honest and la la la. I was like, yeah, I probably curse too much, like, especially for my mother's liking, because my mom's a minister. But if we don't speak to the people in the language that they want to hear, the changes that we hope for are irrelevant. you know, part of my success as a teacher is because I speak my voice. If I came in speaking the Queen's Standard English, they'd be like, who is this wanna, like, who's this brother? Like, for real? Like white people would be suspicious and black people would be like, this brother's crazy. You know what I mean? So like, I speak to all people from my authentic voice. And this is another reason why I use sound. Imagine the vibrational shaping that takes place when you're surrounded by beautiful sound. It has an impact not only on your voice, but your thoughts. And so when we talk about deepening and sharing insight and vision, that we have to come up with not only our personal practices, but our community practices that sustain and nourish and nurture us unless and until, right? So the elders of the civil rights movement took breaks because they knew that the work was going to take a long time. They weren't consumed with, this has to be done tomorrow. Look, you know, Martin Luther King, the day before he was assassinated, said, I might not get there with you. So it's the willingness to offer of yourself from your heart, expecting nothing in return. You know, from a yogic perspective, that's karma yoga and bhakti, right? So like, karma is just doing the work for the sake of the work, and bhakti is doing the work from a sake of devotion. So I'm devoted to doing this work in this spirit in service to alleviating the suffering of those who cross my path, right? So that's the first quote I wanted to read. The second quote is on page 16 in my version. It's on the subchapter of the Negro Revolution. Never in American history had a group seized the streets, the squares, the sacrosanct business thoroughfares, and the marbled halls of government to protest and proclaim the unendurability of their oppression. Had room-sized machine turned human, burst from plants that housed them, and stalked the land in revolt, the nation could not have been more amazed. Undeniably, the Negro had been an object of sympathy and wore the scars of deep grievances, but the nation had come to count on him as a creature who could quietly endure, silently suffer, and patiently wait. He was well-trained in service, but in whatever the provocation, he neither pushed nor spoke back. So when we talk about until systemic oppression is erased, it's erased through confrontation. Like, we can't hope idly that the powerful are gonna be like, oh shit, I was tripping. You know, like, you can't hear your rights, here you go. We have to resource ourselves and declare our worth. And as we declare our individual worth, hopefully see the collective worth of us all, and then go to those for whom they're seeking to subvert their influence on us, be like, nah, no more. Mm-mm. I see the trick that you're playing. And so when we're resourced and in deep practice, the other, like, this sounds hippie, but trust me, like, I'm on some next level shit, meaning all this sound, if someone's full of it, I can hear it. Or I'll talk to a friend, I'm like, how are you? They're like, I'm fine. I'm like, you're not. And if you don't want to talk about it, give me that. But to say you're not. So when we are resourced, when we are in deep practice, and when we clear the mind of distractions, that's part of the reason why I did the sound. Like, I flooded your mind and your brain with cool stuff for 4 minutes, right? So that's the native tongue of the brain. So the brain is like, whoo, wow. You know, like, I'm not like doom scrolling Twitter or hearing someone tell me what I can't do, right? I'm at peace. And so if the mind is at peace, the body can relax. And then that's where discernment rises. That's where conscious awareness rises. And when you've got discernment and conscious awareness, it lays the foundation for, like, the elimination of subterfuge. You know what I mean? Like, if you hear clearly and see clearly, you can call a spade, be like, no, this ain't it, dog. I got nothing, this ain't it. So That's what that quote means to me. Also, one other thing I'll read from that, this quote made me chuckle, laugh out loud. Same section. Just as lightning makes no sound until it strikes, the Negro Revolution generated quietly. But when it struck, the revealing flash of its power and impact of its sincerity and fervor displayed a force of frightening intensity. 300 years of humiliation, abuse, and deprivation cannot be expected to find voice in a whisper. Oh! Whew. The storm clouds did not release a gentle rain from heaven, but a whirlwind which has yet to be spent its force or attained its full momentum. So, first of all, what a wordsmith. Like, as someone who's cobbling together a manuscript, I'm just like, I'm inspired / hella intimidated, whatever. Like, you know, that's just my humanity coming out. But that level of confrontation, so that sentence like articulates what I was talking about before, like the resourcing, the consistent and consistent resourcing over time in community allows you to see clearly. And then when you see systemic oppression, like if it's in community, we're just like, nah. Mm-mm. And if you resource without advertising, they won't see it coming. Right? So it's funny when I usually have like at least like one mala on. I don't have any on at the moment, but people are like, that's a pretty necklace. I was like, do you know how much time I spend throwing these beads in prayer? Yeah, it's pretty, sure, thanks. And I am preparing myself through devotion and recitation to alleviate suffering, my own, and then those who cross my path. So when I either find or create a community that's like-minded, we resource together and then impeach presidents, you know, or, right, you know, like, win with a landslide through organizing during a pandemic, right? So like the resourcing and community are inescapable to talk about the erasure of systemic oppression, because oppression is not going to release itself. It has to be forced to. It has to be a forced reckoning through moral clarity and absolute courage, which comes from opening the heart. So I'll stop because I've talked for 20 minutes straight, but want to pause there and just open it up for any questions or comments that you might have. And I hope they warned you, I'm a lot. I'm a blessing, but I'm a lot. Please don't be shy, anything goes.
I have a question.
What's up?
All right. First off, that introduction, thank you for that. To see someone walk and speak, to model the confidence I've been starting to notice more consistently within. It's like, what do I do with this? I got a model of that today. So thank you for that.
Gratitude.
It's interesting that your talk went the way it did, because I'm working on this idea, and I like how you talked about oppression has to be confronted.
Yep.
And I am actually working on a manuscript myself, but almost done with it. And I'm playing with this idea of willful ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
And basically the chapter, you know, kind of defining willful ignorance. To me, willful ignorance almost feels like a more palatable kind of precursor to addiction.
Okay.
I write a lot of like Garbo Mate and stuff. And so for me, the idea of willful ignorance, which is fueling those qualities of white supremacy, the relentless urgency, the dehumanization, the profit margins, has been practiced so long, it's an addiction.
Mm-hmm.
Do it to ourselves, regardless of the outcome. For many other, you know, But the idea of willful ignorance, so what I'm doing is I'm inviting people, I think, to... It almost sounds like what I'm inviting them to do is to create the conflict within themselves that you're saying needs to, or you might be implying might need to come from community. I don't even want to say from the outside, but from, right, just that dynamic of community. Because I think what really struck me was the idea of the quote from Dr. King, storm of 300 years building, right? It's not just going to we're going to be here for a minute. Like, we're going to be here for a good minute. Mm-hmm. And I'm realizing how he almost kind of said that in a, for me, kind of getting a new prophetic sense in that he was even like, even from my perspective, whatever needs to be eliminated, like, we'll get to it, right? It's in the process.
Mm-hmm.
But even it doesn't stop there. Like, we're going to, this is a never non-ending, non-beginning sort of, well, kind of has a beginning, right? But at least a non-ending kind of cyclical nature.
I think
I'm asking if you could dig into more about that conflict for approaching oppression, maybe either from the individual, like, inner work,
mm-hmm.
or from that community dynamic.
Yes. So thank you for that. And thank you for the kind words. Like, you can imagine that I'm kind of a unicorn on all these spaces, but the beauty of being the unicorn is that I can fly. Right. So, like, when people are like, oh my God, like, oh, this guy is like, look, like, I gave a speech one time at Howard University. I worked in, like, presidential advance, which is like high stakes event planning. Like, if you mess up, it's in the New York Times. If you do well, no one cares. Right. So, like, I was at it's called Advance Camp, and it was at Howard, and all my colleagues were talking about how we're a loving community, blah, 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 and y'all, the hair on my neck stood up, and I started to cry. I was like, you racist mother, like, and so rather than me getting mad, I gave the speech of my life where basically I was just like, they're sitting here telling you that this is a ecumenical, like, meritocracy, like, this is a clique. And they tried to kill me on the side of the road, but, like, next time, and I looked at, like, one person specifically in the audience, 2,000 people in the audience, I looked at this guy, I was like, next time, shoot to kill. And then just kept going and going and going. And someone was like, I can't believe that you did that. I can't believe that you did. I was like, listen, you all were lying. And this yoga meditation thing, I cannot listen to this. And the other thing about it, on some real full circle Black hippie shit, is that it was almost 15 years to the day that I did my first political event. Guess where that event was? At Howard. So I was near a full circle completion. I'm in this moment. Something, they were lying, and I got, and it was almost my turn to speak. And, you know, I was coached to stay in my chair. Ancestors basically took me up and was like, go to the podium. So I went to the podium and spoke. And I knew that that it was going to hurt their feelings, but I also knew I had a higher job to do, which is tell these other people the truth. And so this is where, like, my Christian faith came in. I was like, y'all ain't get me up here to, like, do nothing, you know what I mean? So if I'm gonna speak this, you got me, right? So, like, I start speaking, then they put on the confidence monitor, take your seat. I'll never forget this. The third time they put it up, I was like, y'all, I went to Yale. I saw that the second time. I'm still within my time. Take that shit off the confidence monitor. And I mentioned that because it embarrassed them so much that they had, what are they gonna do? They couldn't take the mic out of my hand because energetically, I knew I had 2,000 people that would go apeshit if they came at me. That's number one. Number two, I wish they would. At Howard, you know what I mean? Not only might you catch my elbow, but you don't wanna mess with, like, you don't wanna mess with a brother at Mecca, right? When I'm channeling spirit. So, were I not resourced, I would be like, you want me to do what? But I was so resourced and present that when the conflict had to happen, because what they were trying to do, like you were talking about, is systemic oppression. Take your seat, blah, 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 blah. No. Take your seat. Oh, I told you no, though. And I'm not going anywhere. That only comes from the willingness to confront yourself about your demons, the things that you carry, so that when you confront someone else, that's not weighing you down no more. So one begets the other, at least from my reckoning. So it's not a conflict to me. It's one leads you to the other. So when you look at your stuff with compassion, take the lessons, harvest the wisdom, release what doesn't serve, you grow. Then when you grow, you gotta, you know, you can't be wearing high water pants, you gotta buy new pants, right? So like when I grew in that moment, I had to leave that world to do other stuff. But that other stuff was teaching meditation to members of Congress while we were impeaching the mother, you know what I mean? So like me doing my work, looking these people in the face, being like, you talk all this equality stuff, how many people of color have been on this stage? Please. And like, y'all like me now, but for 4.5 years, you had me on a blacklist. My cat got your tongue, you didn't do it, right? So like, it's that level of, and again, I grew up listening to too much Public Enemy to stand down from people talking out the side of their mouth on some bullshit. So to me, it's not an opposition, or it's symbiosis, right? So like you do the work on yourself, settle into that space, then you're like, oh man. Because the other thing I'll mention in that story, which is analogous to what I'm trying to teach, is that one of my buddies who I knew in that world was like, Reggie, I can't believe that you basically shot your horse and was like, you're not welcome in this town anymore. I was like, I don't need the horse, brother. I got wings, I can fly. You can go in on horseback, brother. I'm a mythical creature in service of the gods. I got wings. Like, so you can try and shame me, white boy, but no. That's yours. So I would not have been able to say that if I didn't 4 or 5 years ago look in the mirror and be like, Reggie, why when oppression happens to you, do you take that personally? Meaning I was in a self-destructive loop. I'm so stupid. I'm so la 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 la. But through confronting that, I'm like, no, actually, I'm doing the best that I can. These Bamas change the rules. And then get mad at me when, so through these practices over and over again, I saw the low grade game, you know, the old school outcast joint, vibrate higher, was able to vibrate higher and then leave them in the dust. Did that answer your question?
Yes, and I swear I'm a philosopher. So yeah, resource.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also in therapy spaces. So I'm gonna reflect back what I think I'm hearing on resources. Resources sounds like, I'll give my examples. I don't like speaking for other people.
Mm-hmm.
Resource sounds like staring PTSD in the face when a tornado was coming at you last week and going, you know what? Screw this. I'm not panicking.
Mm-hmm.
Breathe into my damn belly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and if Mother Nature takes me out with the piece of, like, that's pretty dope. So cool. And if not, I got work to do tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And running through that and then taking that and realizing some of my clients are having moments,
yeah,
just associative moments and whatnot. And they go, oh, how did you do it? And it feels like that resourcing comes from inside, doing that inner working. And it also feels generative, because I feel like compassion is often budgeted in some sort of idea of scarcity, yet people say it's not a scarce thing, but right. The practice of compassion is a scarce practice. But what I'm realizing is it's a self-generative practice.
Absolutely.
Because when I'm walking through a client through a disassociative moment and their worst fear standing in front of their mental eye, and I go, we are not afraid right now.
Right.
Let's breathe through that.
Mm-hmm.
I'm expending compassion, but I'm generating it for the next time I'm having a moment and my PT is, right? Like, yeah. So this idea of resourcing, I'm loving this, but I'm wondering, especially in the political dynamic, how is that happening in community? What does that look like between very different beings, you know, kind of running around out in the wild. How does that look?
So I taught you, I can send you the link if you want. I taught a compassion series for my practicum for a mindfulness, 2-year mindfulness training course that I took. And the title was On Compassion, So What, Who Cares, and Why It Matters. Where I basically talked about compassion is one of the most misunderstood concepts in all of our world, because by design, compassion is indefatigable. It is inexhaustible. Our capacity to hold space for it may have limitations, but compassion in and of itself is inexhaustible. And the resourcing is noticing your capacity, right? So it's taking space, taking stock. Okay, this is what's happening. Do I approach this? No, I can't do this right now. Or maybe I can go a little bit towards it. Maybe I can't. But consistently showing up in a way that confronts with an open heart what would otherwise terrify you or limit you. But doing so, and it's not for me, because I teach people, I'm teaching like an online sadhana now, where our meditations are like 5 minutes. Like our physical practice is 15 minutes. Because I'm showing you how quickly you can get to do repair and then rest in the repair. You know, the meditative and the yogic industrial complexes want you to think that 90-minute classes and retreats in tropical places are the only ways that you can experience peace. My teaching practice, which I forgot in my introduction, is called active peace, because I had to be peaceful in my body right here and live in that peace. But that peace came about through day after day after day after day. Some days it was like, I'm just gonna like, you know, some days it would be walking meditation. Some days it would be in my journal, these motherfuckers did it again. Right? Whatever it was, I held space for it to be, started looking at it from this place, not this place. So non-judgment, judgment. You know, and this, the other interesting thing about my teaching practice is the two patron saints are Jimi Hendrix and Prince. So you can see the Prince pillow right there. I saw this interview with Prince one time where he was just like, we use the mind for what it's for. It's a filing cabinet. We think with our hearts. And I was like, whoa, right? Like, were you the incarnation of Shiva, Prince? Like what is happening here, right? But for me, resourcing is not just about like holding, like seeing the tornado coming. It's like, okay, so this is my process. This ain't working. Can I shift this? Can I tinker with this? And having a curiosity about it, which to me undercuts the fear. Veronica.
Yeah, I have a question I'm trying to figure out. Am I freezing? By the way, I've had internet issues today. I'm trying to figure out how to piece it all together. So bear with me and everyone help me too if you can. So this idea of showing up with compassion and that it's always available, I believe that. And in practice, I come from a background, a family where boundaries were not a thing. Like I never really learned that and never figured out how to tell what I need or, you know, how to resource myself or care for myself. And so I often am quick. I don't even know if, I just don't know that I think about when does it make sense to try to show up with compassion and keep engaging versus when do I need to make a choice that it's actually not, it's either not productive for the other person, it's not productive for me. I don't know, but there's something in that, there's like a tension, I think, in when do we keep showing up and saying, might you consider this? Mm-hmm. Which I wrote down because I will use it. That's amazing. But like, so when do we keep trying? Might you consider?
Right.
And when do we actually say, you know, might I consider this is not right for me?
So
yeah.
The way I teach compassion is this: you can't give what you don't have. Right. So the initial practice is being okay with yourself with what you got. So for many years for me, this is I'll try not to go filibuster, but like when I finished my third yoga teacher training, it was me and like a whole bunch of white women. And people were like, Reggie, what are you afraid of? And I was like, permission to speak freely? They're like, yeah. I was like, y'all. Yeah, like, what do you mean? I was like, listen, white women since the dawning of America have hypersexualized us. We've been hung from trees. You know what I mean? I've been in yoga spaces where people would look at me when I walked in the room and clutch their purse when I like had the same, you know what I mean? So like, I'm scared of y'all. And guess what my majority demographic that I teach is? Right. So I had to give voice to that. And then once I said it, and then like I would teach, and then it would just, people would show up. I'd be like, yo, you can't really hold this fear anymore. You really got to work this out, right? Like, so in the beginning, it was like, I can't deal with this. And that was my teacher training. But I was like, once things started to shift, I'm like, may I be okay with how I feel? May I be okay with how I just said this? And then by me being okay with how I felt, something began to shift. And I realized that I was holding on to some things that I didn't need to hold on to anymore. So I set them to the side. And then the abundance that we talk about from a compassionate perspective that I gave to myself, I was able to then be like, okay, maybe I should consider saying this. Maybe I should do this, you know, like, but I had to take care of myself first. So you can never, and from my opinion and from my experience with metta, you can't go wrong by being like, I just don't got it right now. And may I be okay with not having it right now? You know, the hardest part in compassion practice, two. One is showing it to yourself. The second one is being compassionate with people you don't like or who have caused you harm. And one of the ways I teach that is like, it's kind of ludicrous to expect someone who visited harm upon you for you to be like, yeah, hey, immediately. Like crazy, that's crazy. But what you can do and what I have done in the past is be like, may I be okay with how angry I am and how shitty you treated me? And then I would start there. And then once I was okay with that, then I'd be like, okay, so what's the root of this? Oh, it's this. It's this one experience that I had. So then I had to like call on forgiveness of myself, right? Because it's okay not to be okay, especially when harm has been visited upon you. And if I didn't, so basically, long story short, you got to give to yourself first, otherwise you can't give to anybody else. The most compassionate boundary you can set is this one. And then behind, but you can't stay here, right? Like this can eventually become this, which eventually becomes this. Does that make sense? Is that helpful?
It's so helpful and it's interesting. I went through a coaching training last year and we were asked to come up with a physical stance that embodies our practice or what we aspire to. And mine is actually, I don't know if I can stand and show it, but it's this. It's a so one hand out and one hand here, because that balance of both right. is what I strive for, even though I'm not quite at where I aspire to be yet. But yeah, thank you. That was
beautiful. For sure. For sure. Thank you for helping me remember what I've already taught.